From the Media Factory in the south end of Burlington, Vermont, this is 99.3 FM, WBTV LP Burlington, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro.
Today on Write the Book, you'll hear
an interview with the author David Shields, internationally best-selling author of 20 books, including Reality Hunger, named one of the best books of 2010 by more than 30 publications. The Thing About Life is That One Day You'll Be Dead. Black Planet, which was a finalist for the National Book Critics Circle Award. And Other People, Takes and Mistakes. A film adaptation of his book, I Think You're Totally Wrong, A Quarrel, co-authored with Caleb Powell, was released by First Pond Entertainment in 2017. A recipient of Guggenheim and NEA fellowships and a senior contributing editor of Conjunctions, Shields has published essays and stories in the New York Times Magazine, Harper's, Esquire, Yale Review, Salon, Slate, McSweeney's, and Believer. So his latest book is The Trouble with Men, Reflections on Sex, Love, Marriage, Porn, and Power, published by Mad Creek Books. It is an immersion into the perils, limits, and possibilities of human intimacy. At once a love letter to his wife, a nervy reckoning with his own fallibility, a meditation on the impact of porn on American culture, and an attempt to understand marriage, The Trouble with Men balances the personal and the anthropological, nakedness, and restraint. Shields probes the contours of his own psyche in marriage, marshaling a chorus of other voices that leaven, deepen, and universalize his experience, his ultimate goal being a deconstruction of eros and conventional masculinity. When I spoke to David Shields, I read this quote from his book, and then I asked him to talk about it. He writes, "With all the memoirs being written that are naive victim narratives, I thought it might be useful to write a book that tries to ask interesting questions about pain, rather than simply invoking it as a badge." I hope you enjoy our conversation.
I think, you know, there is, I don't want to do a huge drive-by of every memoir, but, you know, obviously there's a huge genre, what do they call it, you know, sort of, whether it's illness memoir or sort of kind of suffering porn, or, you know, where they're, you know, the book after book, and some of them are good, and some of them are ordinary, and some of them are bad, but there's obviously a lot of books, and these go back centuries, but they've been particularly popular the last, say, 30 years, and, you know, I would say that even sort of some of my books you could possibly categorize as that, but, you know, there's an awful lot of books in which somebody has done somebody wrong, and whether it's a husband or a wife or a parent or a stepbrother or a father, and those are a legitimate thing, but they often seem to me to be, in my view, somewhat, you know, of, you know, sort of naive to say that all the problem is out there, and that, you know, that I had, say, an abusive mother or abusive father or whatever. And not, to me, the whole challenge of the book is to ask, I hope, somewhat harrowing questions away about the ways in which the human animal and the person of myself is drawn towards self-immolation or towards self-punishment or self destruction, or at least likes to flirt with it. You know, I mean, the book I just published a few months ago called Nobody Hates Trump More Than Trump, right. An Intervention. I try to argue that Trump is, you know, I try to do kind of a psychohistorical analysis of Trump and the culture, and I think he's a hugely, hugely self-destructive human being. He's obviously a very destructive human being, too, but he's also just sort of tragicomically self-destructive. So to answer your question slightly briefer, just that, you know, I'm trying to ask, you know, how are we pain-driven individuals? And, you know, at one point in the book, I talk about how you could hardly think of a so-called major modernist writer who wasn't sort of famously, exhibitionistly masochistic. I mean, it's just simply true. You know, Kafka, Virginia Woolf, Thomas Mann, James Joyce, Proust. I mean, there seems to be something almost in people, but maybe particularly writers, mm-hmm. that, you know, is very interestingly self whatever, what's the word? Not self-defeating, but self-questioning, self-destructive.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that all is very consistent with the reputation of writers as being addicts and alcoholics as well.
That's a good point.
People in pain.
I was just going to quote, before I forgot, this wonderful line of Sarah Manguso, who's a friend of mine. I quote her in the book, and she read an early draft of the book, and she said, maybe all writers are serious bottoms. You know, she's sort of using SM lingo of tops and bottoms, and that maybe there's something in the writerly creature. Because if you're a top, you know, someone who wants to be dominant or sort of whatever, a person bestriding the universe, it's hard to think of a single writer who is like that. I mean, in terms of the whole point of writing, of thinking, is to question stuff. And I think if you're not a questioning person, that you're not a writer. And the moment you are a questioning person, you tend to find, I think, relatively dark places within yourself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay, let's see. I wanted to talk about the way that the book is written. The first section of the book is titled, Let's Say I'm Writing a Love Letter to You. And at first, this seemed to me like the prose was directed at the reader, drawing us in and confiding. And then it became really clear that there was this very specific you who was not the reader, but your wife. So I wanted to know, was that always how this book was going to be written? Was this always to whom the book was going to be directed as you started out?
I mean, how much time do you have? Because this book went through so many iterations, as you can well imagine, that in a way the book was heavily focused in its writing the last maybe, I don't know, 3 or 4 years. But really, I've been taking notes on it in a way for, my goodness, you know, easily 15 years. And at one point, I had literally 3,000 pages of notes. I mean, albeit a huge amount of repetition in that, a huge amount of, it was, you know, 20 pages of, you know, scientific articles here, you know, here and there, just, you know, endless old passages of mine I wanted to revisit. You know, I would just sort of shoehorn in, you know, some 50-page essay by Leo Bersani or whatever. But I had literally, you know, I think it was, you know, like sort of 15 notebooks of these huge, you know, totaling 3,000 pages. I've tried various iterations of it from, I tried a version as a novel in which there was a couple, a husband and wife, almost like Nicholson Baker's You and I, but different. A husband and wife have a sort of no-holds-barred conversation one night about their marriage and their sexual life and their sexual fantasies, and I think that could be a good book. It's not probably a book I am meant to write these days. I try to...
since you've decried novels.
Exactly. Or just that, I mean, it's more just, you know, decried them because I no longer am very good at writing them anymore. But and then there's a version in which I can't remember the various versions. Definitely a novel version, a straight version, an essayistic version, kind of a book-length essay. And then somehow, because it seems to be the way that my mind and brain work, I seem to cull all these quotations. And there was a version, a bad version, relatively recently, in which I made very clear that it was the reader I was talking to the whole book, and became the sort of reader as person whom the writer was trying to seduce. And that was just this horrifically bad version, you know, where I made explicit that the you is both the wife or the wife figure and the reader. And then I don't have very much distance from the book. I haven't read it in the last 6 months, except through galleys and stuff. But frankly, I'm just astonished I got the book together. I didn't think I would ever write the book, just because, you know, it's obviously the very, very challenging material on a personal and literary level. And I just tried version after version, whether I didn't know if I had the literary chops, the emotional chops, the intestinal fortitude. So I'm kind of startled that it even came together to the degree it did. And I sort of like the version where it is, there's a thread of throughout the book. I mean, I think of the core of the book being this very acerbic love letter from a man, some version of me, to a you, some version of my wife. That's, I don't know if you agree. That's sort of the core of the book, and everything spins off of that.
Yeah, I mean, it keeps coming back to that, although
right.
anybody can read the book and not feel left out of the premise.
Right. I mean, did you feel sort of addressed as you? Because in a way, there is a sense in which the you, I don't know if it would have to be a woman who's a reader, or if a man, some men have read the book, friends of mine, and they felt they were being addressed as readers, especially if they're close friends of mine, or some women writer friends who said, like, it's weird because it's so intimate, the conversation between the speaker and the you. I mean, I don't know if the reader feels directly addressed or not exactly.
I feel like it was a relief to be able to say, well, that's his wife.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't have to think about
right.
the things that I found uncomfortable, although I know that's
right.
not your point.
Right.
But
right.
I think both.
No, I think that rings true. And I think, you know, discomfort, for better or worse, is sort of my métier, that, you know, I do a lot of my books, you know, flirt with, you know, I hope, sort of readerly and writerly discomfort, for better or worse. That's my go-to. That's what gets me to the page.
Right.
You know, that I've always loved this line of Picasso's, you know, good taste is the enemy of great art. I'm terribly interested in a way, kind of bad taste, stuff that, you know, is not what you're supposed to say.
Right.
Like, yeah. I've always have loved this line of Sally Teasdale. Here I am quoting again as we talk, but Sally says, you know, and I think she has a blurb on the book, and I quote her a bit in the book, and she has a wonderful book called Talk Dirty to Me, which in a way was the kind of inspired me to write this book, and that was a book that she wrote many years ago. But she says, you know, what are you afraid of writing about? That's your real subject.
Yeah.
And I was just constantly thinking to myself, you know, what am I afraid to say? And that became my sort of mantra trying to write the book.
Yeah. Now, so at first the book seemed to be like a series of questions that sort of asked itself about the book's inspiration, and they became almost poetic, and they seemed almost organized in stanzas at times. Questions about why am I writing this and what do you think of it? And I'm not actually looking specifically at the questions right now.
Right.
But some are your questions and statements, and some are quotes or paraphrases of other sources. And I know that you're known for collage-like structures. So I wonder if you can talk about writing this way. You know, when you said you had like 3,000 pages of material, that doesn't surprise me, but we should mention that this book is very, you know, boiled down, it's less than 150 pages. So you've really worked to cull through your material.
It's very short. It's 139 pages. I sort of have it in front of me. I just got, you know, the copies just got sent to me
right.
by the publisher the last couple of days. It's a really, quite a physically beautiful book with that. I don't know if you have a copy of the cover. I think, you know, it's a gorgeous cover, and it's beautifully printed. It starts on page 3, so it's only 136 pages or something, and a lot of white space, a lot of, I forgot how many words it is. It's only maybe 35 or 40,000 words. You know, it's like a long, you know, I just love the form of the book-length essay. But
right.
I'm sorry, Shayla, that you had a question there that I'm stepping on.
No, you're sort of already, you're talking about it. You know, I just asked you how it is, talk about writing in these kind of collage-like structures.
Right. Well, you know, right now I'm teaching a graduate seminar in literary collage, so I'm just totally obsessed with this form. And I am intrigued by the fact that, you know, as a you know, as a younger writer, you know, I'm 62 now, and in my 20s and 30s, I wrote 3 novels, a very conventional novel, a buildings roman, a growing up novel. I wrote a novel in stories. Then trying to write my 4th novel, I just found I couldn't, for all kinds of complicated reasons, just novelistic gestures had gone flat on me. And so I wrote a book called Remote Reflections on Life in the Shadow of Celebrity, published about 20 years ago. That became my first book of literary nonfiction and my first book of literary collage. And I've sort of worked in that form ever since.
Right.
And at this point, I almost have a kind of task sheet of what I do with these collage books, whether books on race or reality hunger or sex or war photography or reality. I mean, I generally choose some huge topic that I'm obsessed with and that I'm confused about. And then I do I shoot a lot of film. I mean, not literally, but I just sort of gather stuff, just often over many years. And I have this huge file, you know, like whether when I did a book called Reality Hunger, which was a book published about 10 years ago, or this book, I just sort of gather stuff, you know, those 3,000 pages. And then at some point, I take a deep breath and just say, okay, I'm tired of researching this. I'm tired of writing new stuff. I'm definitely am repeating myself. I'm not really learning anything terribly new in my reading and writing and my emailing friends for book suggestions. So I'm going to take a deep breath and read everything I have. And that becomes a really challenging moment because, you know, you're trying to separate gold from dross at that point. And at that point, the 3,000 pages start shrinking very quickly into, you know, usually one-tenth of that. As a huge amount of the material is hugely repetitious or bad or cliched or shy or something. And I basically just try to highlight any lines, sentences, even words that just jump out at me as to return to that earlier phrase, you know, sort of anything that feels discomforting, that makes me nervous, that makes me sit up, I tend to circle those and or I highlight them or something. And then I start pushing them into what I call silos, sort of let's say I had a bunch of rhetorical questions, as you know, the part that you were quoting from earlier about,
right. Yeah.
You know, am I talking to you? Do you want me to write the book? Are you afraid? Am I afraid of writing the book? Do you want to read it? You know, why are we married? Are we, you know, do you love me? All those things. Like at some point, of course, those were questions scattered throughout my 3,000 pages, and I just sort of pushed them together. So I'm not sure if I'm answering your question other than, you know, I just, at a certain point, I start pushing together like material with like material, and then I try to organize the overall book so that, you know, obviously those rhetorical questions belong pretty early in the book because they're sort of me trying to get the book started.
Right.
And, you know, asking myself and asking my wife if I am willing to write the book. And so it's a very strange, not very time-efficient process, but it seems to be the only way I know how to actually work.
Yeah. Well, one thing that occurred to me as I was reading the book is that I realized as I was reading some of the quotes and allusions in the book, which I should mention again, the title is The Trouble with Men, Reflections on Sex, Love, Marriage, Porn, and Power. So as I was reading these quotes and allusions, I realized that I felt this kind of great freedom in letting you take me through the thoughts of yourself and these other people. I didn't have to worry that I hadn't read Pliny the Elder, for example.
Right.
You know,
I'm not sure I've read Pliny the Elder either, but yeah.
So that was interesting to me that I could just sort of just let go and not worry so much, like, have I read that reference? Do I know that book? Who is this author he's talking about? You know, it's just like these are things that he's chosen to place next to each other in context, and that's how I am getting his information. One question I did have is, did you feel a responsibility to use the quotes in context, like to keep them relevant to their original meaning, or not so much?
As you can probably guess, not so much in the sense that, you know, that, like, for instance, I mean, I think it's not like I hugely decontextualize people. So, you know, there might be a quote from, you know, as you say, Pliny the Elder.
Or, right.
I'm just opening the book here to a quote. There's a quote by Laurie Moore, you know, and then I see a quote by, you know, Brenda Phillips, I see a Saul Bell. Brenda Phillips is actually a pseudonym of a writer friend of mine who wanted to use a different name, and she's quoted throughout the book. She has some wonderful lines through it. But, you know, I think, you know, I don't think of the quotes as being radically decontextualized or recontextualized. And so I think to me, what I want in the book, I mean, at some point, with quite a few of my books, I do quote extensively, and I always try to figure out how to make the book have a real organic flow so that the reader isn't trapped in worrying about Pliny the Elder and is more
right.
involved in the organic flow of the book's argument, you know, as the book moves, I think, relatively nicely through these five chapters. The first chapter is sort of about the book itself. Second chapter is about childhood. The third chapter is about the marriage itself. The fourth chapter is about porn. And the fifth chapter is maybe my favorite chapter. It's a short chapter, which I just try to understand what I think is the tragic nature of sexual attraction and marriage, and that there's something beautifully tragic about romantic love, and that I try to own that tragedy, you might say. But I guess for me, I'm trying to think of what to say other than I think the quotes are relatively true to their sources. They're in very small brackets so that the reader doesn't over worry who's saying what. And to me, if in earlier drafts, some writer friends of mine thought I was quoting too much, so they kept saying, there's too many quotes and there's not enough you. And I think in this final version, there's sort of a quality in which, I don't know if you felt this, Shayla, where it almost doesn't matter who's talking, it should feel like a strong reverb back to me, the speaker. So that even if it's, you know, Saul Bellow or Philip Roth or Susan Sontag or Sophocles, there's a sense in which it's all part of an argument I'm making in which I want the reader to engage in. And there should be a sense in which, in a weird sense, I'm saying all of it, even if it's through this Greek chorus of other people. I don't know if you experienced the book that way or if that seems rather grandiose on my part.
Well, you know what? I can't say I thought about this while I was reading it, but now that you're saying this, it reminds me of another kind of collage where, you know how sometimes they'll take a lot of different pictures and put them together in a larger picture that if you stand back far enough, it's Marilyn Monroe's face or something like that. But
exactly,
as you get closer,
yeah,
you
sure.
see all the little... So yeah, I mean, sure. I actually think that is how I see the book.
Right.
Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know if you were, I mean, as you read it, did you say, like, gee, I worry that David is violating the context of these quotes in which he has just a single line from Scott Spencer or something? Like,
no.
Where is the rest of the context?
No, I actually wondered more about sort of like the legal details of what your publisher has to go through to use all these quotes. You know, like what...
Oh, I see.
What requires permission and what do you have to do, like, as far as acknowledgement? Do you know what I mean? Like,
oh, I see what you mean.
Yeah,
that was, I mean, I've become all too conversant in all manner of fair use questions and transformation, appropriation, intellectual property, copyright. An awful lot of my work in book and film is, depends on fair use.
Right, yeah.
And so basically, this book did not present a huge number of legal questions. For one, I do cite everything. Then that we do have a line at the beginning of the book, which I think is a useful disclaimer. Let's see if I can find it. I say, a bracketed name at the end of a paragraph indicates a direct quotation or a close paraphrase of something someone else has written or said. So, and then also, you know, you can quote briefly as long as you're quoting under 250 words, and there are very few, if any, quotes more than 250 words. So you really have relative carte blanche if you're citing and you're quoting. And then... and then there's a couple of lines of poetry which I wanted to have in the book, and I had to edit those down. Poetry, for complicated reasons, which I still don't totally understand, you can only quote a line or two, and I, at a couple points, I had four lines. And so in those two cases, I think it was Les Murray, the Australian poet, and someone else whose name I can't, maybe Emily Dickinson, somebody, and then I had to edit them down. And the way this always happens, you know, I always am remorseful about having to edit it down, but then I always like the compression more than the original version. So
I actually
like the fact that the lines are even briefer. So my lawyer always says the law is my muse, that I seem what gets me going in a strange way are works that flirt with legal jeopardy. That seems to be part of my writing MO, for reasons I wish and my bank account wishes weren't the case.
And I in no way questioned that you were going, you know, doing the fair use correctly and being legal and everything. But I do think that listeners who are writers find this interesting because it is
totally.
You know,
no, I'm happy to talk about it. And this film I have coming out this spring called Lynch: A History, which is this documentary film about a Bartleby-esque football player. And, you know, the whole film is curated from 700 clips that we found on the web.
Oh,
and
wow.
So the whole film is fair use appropriation. So it's a huge part of my creative practice.
Okay. Well, I wanted to mention one line that I just laughed out loud, which was marriage as genre, ? I thought that was very funny.
Where is that? Do you have the page marked?
You know what? I didn't mark the page, but it's not that far in. Maybe it's around page 30.
No, I think that was pretty early where I say, am I questioning? Let's see if I can find it.
Yeah, I might be able to find it.
I think it's really early. I think it's on page 4.
Oh, is it really that early?
Or maybe not. It's in the first 10 pages because I was giving a reading from the book in Columbus, Ohio a few days ago, and I thought I came across that line as I quoted at the very beginning.
Oh, okay.
But anyway,
that was
funny
great
that you laughed at that line. It's what made you, I don't know if you're married or if you marriage as genre. It's a funny, like,
it is
what
funny.
It is a genre, isn't it? I mean,
yeah.
In a way, the whole book is about genre and marriage as a genre and bringing it all together. I mean, for some, you know, you think of all those Jane Austen novels and how much they're about marriage as an unbelievably hardwired genre, and so many 19th century novels are about marriage. And so somehow, you know, that what does one say? I mean, it's a brutal thing to say about a marriage, that it is a genre. Everyone wants to think of their marriage as wildly passionate and wildly original, but it's an it's so wired into cultural codes. And so, in a way, this book is a huge violation of marriage as a genre. And, you know, I obviously have had many conversations with my wife about the book. And, you know, in many, many ways, this book is a transgression of marriage as a genre, which is that, you know, the moment you close the door after the party, the couple gets to talk about their own relationship, and that, you know, nobody really knows, as the line goes, what anyone's marriage is like, so that we tend to romanticize a person's marriage, like, oh, they seem so happily married. Nobody has the faintest idea what anyone's marriage is actually like, except possibly the people within the marriage, and not necessarily even them. And they may have radically different views of how the marriage is or is going. So I don't know if I can play with the idea sort of further, other than I'm really interested in genre and violating generic expectations, and I'm very interested in marriage, and apparently in violating some of its expectations. So I think of the book as really about, isn't it? I mean, it's about a lot of things, I hope, but it's partly about violating norms, both of literary norms and marital norms. But I mean, what made you laugh about it?
Well, it was unexpected, and it was outside of, you know, there's so much conversation about genre when you're in writing circles. And so it was just, it made me smile to think of marriage as a genre. But then I wasn't that far into the book yet, so I didn't know exactly what it represented.
Where it's going, yeah.
So I guess I don't know. It just struck me
sure.
Yeah, kind of creative and interesting. Now, I want to just give people a sense of how the book reads. So do you mind if I just read some of the stuff? It's pretty quick.
No, please do. I'm curious how it'll sound.
So, and this is a very radio friendly section because the book is pretty mature in some place. You write, we're programmed to be who and how we are pretty much from birth. And then you follow this by quoting Robert Cohen, who wrote, you cannot deny your own nature, even if your own nature is terribly flawed, even if it's ugly or annoying or hurtful to people, including yourself. And then you write, bummer, which is great. I mean, that's your line. And then and then you have this paragraph about Janice Shapiro's book, Bummer, which is about sadness and pain and looking for happiness elsewhere. And then finally, you have this line from Seneca, if we could be satisfied in any way, we should have been satisfied long ago, which was just such a wonderful end to that section. And it's just this very short section, but it's, I think, kind of representative of how the book is structured, where you have, you know, thoughts of your own, you have thoughts of other people, and they are from all different time periods, and they kind of tie this section nicely together into something to think about and talk about.
Thanks. I mean, that is a really emblematic section, isn't it? That really is how the book works. I mean, in a way, that really is the book's DNA, which you've captured so well in that brief encapsulation. And, you know, shout out to Rob Cohen, who, as you may know, teaches at Middlebury, up the street. He's a wonderful friend and writer and teacher.
He's been on the show. He's a good interview too.
I can imagine. He's very funny and very smart and very performative. So yeah.
Yeah, he's great.
But I mean, that's, I know what you mean. That is sort of the book where you take, I guess it starts with the quote by Rob, and then it goes to me saying bummer, and then it goes to my riff on Janice Shapiro's book, who wrote a good book of short stories, all held together with notions of bummerness. And then where do I go? To Seneca or something before Seneca?
Seneca. Yeah, then you went
Seneca,
to Seneca.
And you're like, yeah, that's sort of the book. Like, in a way, it's almost the whole argument of the book, which is, I mean, in a way, perhaps if, as I give readings, I may pull that passage. But I don't know what to say other than that's sort of how my mind thinks, where I'm culling, I'm curating, I'm juxtaposing. And I think for maybe certain kinds of reader that say, well, like David, where are you in this? You're just quoting a bunch of other people. But I think for a more sympathetic reader, or maybe a reader who's interested in juxtaposition, that's like a really, I hope, sort of a lovely poetic passage. You know, it's like, there's a line of Donald Barthelme that says something like, editing is the essential postmodern instrument, or something like that. I mean, in a way, I think of myself as a radical film editor, where, you know, I hope there's real art to my pushing together Cohen, Shapiro, me, and Seneca in this really tight space, and also at that particular time in the book.
Yeah.
So yeah, that is the book. So, you know, if someone says, like, that sounds boring, a bunch of quotes, they should not pick up the book. But if that sounds, I mean, it is a very, I would say it's a sort of a philosophical book or psychological book. Like, it tries to ask questions at 30,000 feet about, I would call it something like the human sexual animal. Like, yes, it's sort of about me and sort of about my marriage, but really it's sort of this aerial view of the tragicomedy, I think, of the sexual being. And that, you know, it's a pretty aerial view of things, and that I really like aerial views. And, you know, in a way, it's part of why I'm not that much of a fiction writer anymore, although I would argue there's plenty of fictional gestures even in my nonfiction, is that I got kind of a little bored with the granular detail of so many novels, you know, the 500-page novel full of, you know, every jot and tittle about, you know, every little machination of, you know, the farm machinery on the family's farm in, you know, Western Pennsylvania or whatever. Like, I have maybe attention deficit disorder or something. Like, I just like greater speed, compression, velocity, concision. And like, I just like it to move.
Right.
And so I'm drawn to the sort of juxtapositional art that I practice now.
Now, to that idea, I was curious, to what extent are you very stream of consciousness as you're writing, and to what extent is it very intentional? Because sometimes it felt very stream of consciousness, but I also think that sometimes that is an intentional way of writing, you know, to make
right.
it seem that way if it isn't. And I think because of having to cull together all of these quotes in relevant sections, it can't have been that stream of consciousness. So I'm just curious, what is your work state of mind usually?
Yeah, I think I understand what you're asking, which is that, you know, I think there's a writer I'm hugely influenced and hugely love, and I spent a huge amount of time simply rereading his four-volume Smoking Diaries. I quote him a little bit in the book. He's a now-deceased British playwright named Simon Gray, who at the end of his life kept this amazing, not just kept, but wrote this four-volume book called The Smoking Diaries, and it's just an extraordinary, extraordinary book. In that book, he pretends to be, it gives a very strong illusion that he is writing stream of consciousness, to the point of, you know, he pretends at one point that he can't continue the page because a bird pooped on the page, and so that page is, you know, has, you know, that page is blank, or his pen runs out of ink, or, you know, I'm making it sound more postmodern than it really is, but it feels very stream of consciousness, but it's extremely intentional. And
okay,
I think
that's what I figured.
The way that I, like, there's, I mean, I'd have to look at a passage. I'd be happy to look at a passage with you, but in general, almost too much so, an awful lot of these, as I culled 3,000 pages down to the very brief book it is now, it was a very, very patient process that I think feels, and certainly individual writerly choices felt very, you know, I would make quick juxtaposition. I didn't want to be, you know, paralyzed by overthinking everything, and I hope there are some relatively fast moves here and there. But in general, this was all made with a huge amount of conscious choice.
Yeah. Do you mind if I just quote something?
No, please do.
And it's a very, it's a fairly vulnerable section, but that's sort of what my question's about. So,
okay.
So you write, as a little kid, I would start every morning by promising myself and inevitably failing to live up to the promise. Don't cry today. That was very moving to me when I read that. And I felt for that kid. I wondered how hard it was for you to be vulnerable on the page in writing this book. And that's actually a childhood vulnerability. And then there
right.
are all these adult vulnerabilities that are you know, also, you know, kind of moving and in a different
way.
Yeah,
I mean, that's, of all the things in the book, that seems like, you know, fairly anodyne compared to some later revelations,
yeah.
which are, you know, more, you know, whatever, they're more about adult sexuality or more about
yes. yeah.
existential sadness or about, I mean, it gets very, I don't know, I don't have that much distance on it. It gets fairly harrowing in the sense that it gets, you know, pretty intimate, you know, very, sometimes quite explicit.
Yeah.
And it above all, like, it's that whole thing that I really don't like in movies, you know, with so many movies and so many TV shows, that when the couple make love, it's just sort of generic making love. Like, okay, the couple fall into bed and they have a romantic tryst, but that's not really how people make love or have sex. That I really think that, you know, how people make love and how, what their sexual desires are, the real intimacies of sexual fantasy and sexual drive, like, those really matter as a revelation of one's psyche. And I felt, you know, I've read a lot of theory about it, whether it's Robert Stoller, who's very good on this, or Freud, obviously, or Lacan, and, like, I think it really matters. And I think, like, it doesn't really matter unless one either commits a sexual crime or one acts about something out of consent. But I mean, it really matters as, I think, an x-ray of one's soul. I don't think these sexual drives are trivial. Like, it really matters what people desire.
Right.
And so I thought, well, gee, if I'm going to write this book, you know, I can't retreat behind a veil of shyness. And so it is, you know, it's a little, I'm sure friends of mine are a little, I mean, the book is just out, so people are just seeing it, but, you know, sort of serious writer friends of mine just think, like, that is what I do, and they're not particularly startled.
Right.
But I think it's a, you know, I think it's a pretty naked book.
Absolutely.
And I couldn't imagine writing the book without being, I mean, for, you know, I'm trying to think of how to say it, but the kind of work I do, whether even going back to earlier books decades ago, they major in this kind of revelation, because without that revelation, I think the work remains fairly anodyne. And so I try not to make a confession for confession's sake. I try to marry my revelations to a larger cultural and human revelation. So if the whole argument of the book is that, well, let's say, you know, the epigraph of the book is really, in a way, the whole book, where I quote, it's variously attributed to various people, Oscar Wilde and other people, but it looks like a Swiss-German psychoanalyst of the 1930s, Robert McKell, said, everything is about sex except sex. Sex is about power. And,
right.
You know, I feel like if that's the argument of the book, which it really is, well, gee, it was incumbent upon me to try and go into how that plays out in my own psyche and in my own life and my own marriage. So I'm not sure that's answering your question, but it was incredibly hard to write. And I think it's a huge part of why it took me so long to write the book, is I kept on saying, like, I cannot write this book. How will it affect my marriage? How will it affect even my professional standing as either a professor or whatever?
Well, but it's being very well received, as far as I know. I know I've read some wonderful reviews of it, and that must be a relief. But I can't imagine that there must have been a sort of concern as the launch date approached, that, you know, how will this be received? And I'm putting myself out on a limb, and I hope it's worth it. I mean, I imagine that's
totally
all going through your head.
It's going through myself, like, as we talk, really, in the sense that, my God, as recently as maybe two or three weeks ago, I had this sort of dream or fantasy, or even almost like, I swear to God, a month ago, I was going to call the publisher up and just say, can we please cancel the book? This can't happen. Because I was just so like, am I really going, I mean, it wasn't really a desire, but I thought, like, am I really going to publish this book, you know? And because I think there was that recent case of a writer, I think she's an Asian writer who was publishing a novel, and the book apparently had to an American audience what felt like a racist undercurrent.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And she
yeah.
felt so, I don't know if you heard about this, and then so she felt bad that she was oblivious to its undercurrent of incipient racism, and so I think she canceled the book. And anyway, I think it's a quite serious book, and I think I'm really proud of it. I think it's I'll have to try to read it sometime again and see how I think about it, but I think, you know, I think obviously in the wake of Me Too and Trump and all that stuff, that it's like, well, do we want to hear a writer burning down the house of his own sexuality, like a male writer, sort of and sort of not? Like, I thought the timing of the book might be just right or just wrong. And, you know, that we'll see. There have been some very generous reviews in The Guardian and The Washington Post. And, you know, it's been gratifying that people have liked the book so far. And we'll see. I'm sure there will be some pushback reviews. But no, I question it a lot. Like, well, I do feel like I really, you know, there's a wonderful line of the writer and creator of Transparent, the TV show.
Oh, yeah, right.
Jill Soloway, you know, who talks, you know, she has this phrase, I think it's the title of her production company, who's, you know, it's called, you know, Topple the Patriarchy is her sort of mantra, you know, that she wants, you know, she's, I think, she thinks of her, I think she views herself as trans now, or, you know, at least non-binary, and, you know, she's, you know, very invested in the idea of toppling the patriarchy and all that stuff, and all that good stuff, and that, you know, I think in a strange way, I don't know, it's not for me to say as, you know, a late middle-aged, straight, white, middle-class, middle-aged male, so, but, you know, I do think the book is a contribution to that conversation that we'll see if the rest of the culture says so. But, you know, I think a lot of women writers have liked the book, and probably some people aren't going to like the book, but that I think the book, you know, there's this wonderful line that I just love by Antonio Porcia, the Argentinian aphorist. He says this incredible line. He says, "Man is weak, and when he makes strength his profession, he is weaker." Mm. And I actually quote that in the book at some point. And, you know, when I think about Trump, I think he's obviously an incredibly weak person, and he tries to present himself as strong, and that is what makes him weaker. And I think a lot of these Me Too things are often from really damaged people. That doesn't in any way condone what they do, but say Louis C.K. or any of these other people, that they haven't faced their own brokenness, their own weakness, and they, instead of dealing with it, as I hope this book tries to do for myself, these sort of, whatever you want to call them, sort of serial violators, you know, instead of dealing with their own human weakness, they try to hide it and flip it into a kind of projected violation of someone else. And I think the book is actually a contribution to that conversation, that it would, in a strange way, I think the book is a kind of thinking person's marriage manual, that I think, like, if people could have, that might be a little grandiose, but, you know, I feel like if couples could talk with each other super honestly about who they are, they'd actually have a more intimate marriage. And I think it's not, again, this is not for me to say, but, you know, I guess I'm saying it, but on the other hand, I think it's also a book that I hope might have some Me Too application, in the sense that it struggles with and worries about masculine brokenness in a way that I think is useful. I don't know if you agree or if those seem moot to you or what.
I think creating conversation is useful, and I think this book creates conversation. I think it opens up ideas, and whether or not people agree with the ideas, it
right.
creates conversation.
Right.
So, and, you know, I mean, I think that your thoughts are surrounded by the quotes of people that we respect, a lot of them, and you're in good company there. I actually wondered if that in some way gave you more confidence as you approached your launch date, that it's like, oh, well, there are these other quotes from people, so it's not just me.
I know what you mean. There is this sort of, like, why are those quotes there? Are they a buffer? Are they support mechanism? Are they Greek chorus? Are they there to agree with me? Are they there to buttress my arguments? Are they a kind of almost prophylactic to sort of say, like, hey, I might be saying these dark and difficult things, but so are Daphne Merkin and, you know, Brenda Phillips and Susie Bride. I think there's probably an element of covering my left flank there, possibly. But also, I'm just such a quoter, and it's sort of like, you know, the whole book is asking, am I crazy? Why do I have these thoughts? Like, okay, I'm not crazy, and neither are you, dear reader, because some amazingly agile thinkers from, you know, ancient philosophers to very contemporary sexologists have said this is sort of how the human animal behaves. So, yes, I feel like I have my own mildly kinky drives, but according to all these really quite serious thinkers on the subject, you know, join the human parade. People have always been drawn toward these things, and so that it becomes you know, I forget how Whitney Otto says it, and I don't know if I have it here, but she gave the book a nice blurb where she talked about how those quotes work. But anyway, I forget what Whitney said, but...
Well, I have it here. She said, in her blurb, is that what you're talking about?
Yeah.
In her blurb, she says, on the surface, this book is very serious and risky, but there's a wink, and the wink comes in the construction. Shields says extraordinarily candid things, and then instead of weighing the reader down with all these experiences, memories, questions, desires, and analyses, he brings in echoing and countering voices of ancient and modern writers that lift the book right back up into the air. This technique and the brevity make the book both intimate and universal.
I mean, that obviously is a very nice thing for her
to
say, but that rings true to me. I feel like it gives the book altitude. Like, it's like, I do think, I worried again, to return to your first question, which is, you know, I did not want to write a straight-ahead book of, you know, woe is me, or here's me and my little sexual impulses. But it's sort of like, I do think those quotes have this effect of I hope they do, of what Whitney says, which is they make the book feel kind of almost airy and playful and fun, and I hope gesturing towards some universality.
Yeah. Let's see. I want to ask you a couple things just for writers that are listening, and actually for readers who are listening. What have you read lately that you might recommend to listeners, other people's books?
Let's see now. What am I crazy about of late? You know, I'm a huge fan of Sarah Manguso's work, who has a new book out, or a relatively new book out, called 300 Arguments, a series of aphorisms.
Right.
300.
Yeah.
I don't know if you have it. It's this
That's
tiny
a Grey Wolf book, right?
Yeah, it's a tiny blue book published by Grey Wolf maybe a year ago.
Yeah, that was a good book.
I am teaching a course on the aphorism, on aphoristic work, and so they were reading a lot of books, whether Antonio Porcia's Voices or Sarah Manguso's 300 Arguments, or another Vermont writer, Mary Ruffle. I don't know if you know her.
Oh, yeah,
her work.
She's wonderful.
I don't know if she stopped by. She probably doesn't do too many interviews, but there's a wonderful book of hers called Private Property, which I'm a huge fan of. And
is it poetry? You know,
a kind of prose poem, prose poem. And then I'm a huge fan of Amy Fusselman, who has a book out called The Pharmacist Mate, which has a big influence on me. And I really like an earlier book of Maggie Nelson called Bluette.
Oh, yeah.
I quote, which is a really powerful book. And I mean, those are a handful of books that I really love. I can go on and on about
some
other books.
No, that's great. And then what are you working on now? What are you going to be writing next?
Well, I'm working on a new book called The Very Last Interview, a novel, believe it or not, even though I've supposedly written these manifesti against the novel. This book, at least right now, has the subtitle of a novel. Whether it'll be a novel or not, I'm not sure. Oftentimes these books start out as novels and wind out as works of nonfiction. But I'm taking every interview I've ever done where I've been interviewed for a book, and I guess sometimes I've interviewed someone else, and I found every interview I've ever done, either I found it as a print version or I had the audio or video transcribed, and I had something like 2,700 questions. I mean, I had all the interviews, which again had came to hundreds, if not thousands, of pages. And then I somehow had decided I'm going to pull every single question from the interviews. Either I ask a question or they ask a question. It could be just someone saying, you know, can I have a drink of water, or is the interview over? And then I've got 2,700 questions, which I am now both remixing into a pattern. Again, I'm sure this all sounds familiar from our discussion of this book, but I'm also hugely changing the questions and adding new questions, and that it's, you know, it's I'm really having fun with it. It's not probably most people's idea of what a novel is, but it'll be kind of a book-length Q&A between an investigative interviewer who's trying to get the writer to say something, and the writer, you know, some version of myself who's answering the questions and not answering the questions, and
So is this a sort of, is it a sort of universal interviewer with, like, you're not identifying individuals who have
exactly
interviewed?
Okay. Exactly. Like, yeah, it's, yeah, that I'm changing the questions enough that it's lost its moorings from, it's not like I'm saying, okay, this interview was with the Associated Press. It's more just becomes, you know, and it'll just be one, it'll be, it's divided up into small chapters by theme, so that there might be a chapter on, say, I don't know, like, as a kid I had a very bad stutter, so there might be stuff on stuttering, or there might be stuff on childhood or death or genre. And so it'll be, I don't know, we'll see. I've got about 10 chapters done and about 10,000 words. So, it again, it'll be a short book. It'll be a formally odd book, but I hope it'll have some narrative pull through. So that is what I am currently working on.
Okay. Let's see. I always end with a question that has to do with offering advice to writers. So in your case, I wondered if you might have any advice for writers who want to experiment with structure, either specifically collage structure or some other personally untried or unusual structure in their prose.
Advice. I don't write in this weird way on purpose. It's like the only way I can write. It's not like I said, oh, gee, I've written 3 novels and now I want to write something really weird. It was more just that I had written 3 novels. They were okay. You know, they were increasingly sort of formally playful. And then for a variety of reasons, I went off into a different direction. So I don't think, I wouldn't urge people to say, oh, gee, what David's doing sounds interesting. I want to do something weird too. I mean, that's that, you know, that, say, Virginia Woolf, say, when she did her formal experiments, which now seem to us not that strange, but at the time seemed unbelievably strange,
yeah,
that she was just bored by the novels of Arnold Bennett, which were these very popular late Victorian or early Edwardian novels of the time that were super conventional novels. And, you know, as Virginia Woolf said, you know, on or around December 1st, 1910, the world changed forever. And, you know, she was partly serious and partly kidding, but for her, she could no longer write, if she ever did, in this old-fashioned Edwardian way. And that, in a way, I would just say, you know, this thing I always tell students and friends or acquaintances, writers, that, you know, you have to find a form, or at least I urge you to find a form that releases your best and strangest intelligence. And if you are working in a form, as for me, the novel was not releasing my best and strangest intelligence. For many people, the novel is indeed that form, but for me, it wasn't. And so for me, you know, I found in literary collage this unbelievably great housing mechanism for my work, because mm-hmm. I'm very associational and anti-linear. So I guess I would say, I would just urge people to find that form. It could be collage, it could be haiku, but you know, you want a form that plays to your deepest strengths. So I would say that. And then, you know, I'm really fond of this idea that you know, that V.S. Naipaul says, you know, if you want to write seriously, you have to be willing to break the forms. And, you know, Walter Benjamin says, all serious works of literature either dissolve a genre or invent one. And so I think not everyone agrees with all that. You know, you could say there could be a very conventional novel that's written now that's really good. But I guess I would challenge listeners and readers and writers to try to find and maybe read and write in a form that captures what it's like to be alive now in 2019. Whereas I think it's so telling how many novels now are set in the relatively remote historical past. Like, let's set something in 1942 so that will place maybe certain cultural issues, but I feel like so many writers are not hugely wrestling with what it is to write now.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's crucial that content tests form. So I would, you know, it's crucial that the form of the book mirror the stuff that you're writing about. And I think collage is a wonderful way, I think, to capture the oddity of being alive now.
Yeah. Okay. Great. I like that, particularly like the, you know, just sort of the digital age and how fast we're thinking and how fast we want everything to happen. And
yeah, I mean, not to say that we ought to write glorified Twitter feeds. That's not what my work is. But taking the, you know, I do think we are, I mean, personally, like part of the reason that I don't write or read like super conventional slowly moving novels is that I think we can fill in those gaps now. I don't think we need, you know, like David Mamet, who may still live in Vermont too, as he had lived in Vermont for a long time.
Yeah.
I don't know if he's still in the Vermont area.
I don't know.
At least
I think he split his time between New York and Vermont for a long time. I don't know the extent to which he's still here. Yeah.
Right. But, you know, that he says omission is a form of creation, and he says you can tell because you can tell someone who can write from someone who can really write by how much they can leave out. And I'm really fond of that idea. Mm. And that basically, mm-hmm. I do think we can fill in a lot of these narrative gaps, a lot of these psychological gaps that, you know, I don't think that we should write now the way that Balzac wrote in 1830, that we don't need everything explained through, you know, and that I think a lot of what I find exciting about literary collage is that it really assumes, you know, pretty serious intelligence on the part of the reader to make connections and to fill in narrative and emotional gaps. And I just think it's sort of how we think now. I mean, just think of how music, you know, that we don't endlessly rewrite Beethoven's Ninth Symphony, that we don't rebuild the Chartres Cathedral, we don't, you know, repaint the Mona Lisa, that, you know, art should move forward, and that I'm trying to, you know, drag literature kicking and screaming into the 21st century, that, you know, I think literature should mirror contemporary life just as much as visual art and music.
Yeah, yeah. So I want to mention again that the name of the book is The Trouble with Men, Reflections on Sex, Love, Marriage, Porn, and Power by David Shields, published by Mad Creek Books, which is an imprint of The Ohio State University Press in my hometown of Columbus, Ohio. David, thank you very much for speaking with me about your book.
Thank you. I thoroughly enjoyed it.
From the Media Factory in the south end of Burlington, Vermont. This is 99.3 FM WBTV LP Burlington, streaming online at 993wbtv.org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro. You've just listened to an interview with the author, David Shields, about his new book of essays, The Trouble with Men, published by Mad Creek Books. You can learn more about his work at davidshields.com. This broadcast's Write the Book prompt, I won't say this week because we have a couple this week, but this broadcast's Write the Book prompt was generously offered by David Shields, who suggests writing a postcard that simultaneously evokes place and reveals something about the postcard writer that he or she is not aware of. Good luck with your work in the coming week, and tune in next week for another prompt or suggestion. Okay, I have an announcement to make about this show. I'm going to announce this each week from now until it happens. Please help me spread the word. Write the Book begins airing for just a single hour from 4 to 5 p.m. beginning on April 1st. This is not a joke or an April Fool's prank. We'll still be on Monday afternoons, but we will go to a single hour each week from 4 to 5 p.m. As a result, the show will air fewer reruns. If you're a regular listener, you probably realize that a lot of times in the second hour of the show, I'm running reruns. The content of WBTV LP is filling. It's wonderful. There's all kinds of new shows coming in, all kinds of new DJs with ideas. There are also some syndicated shows that we're running, such as Democracy Now! And lots of other shows. And so this show is going to go to 1 hour, and it'll be mostly new interviews. So Thank you for tuning in on Mondays from 4 to 5 starting April 1st. Also, I'm going to be participating in a workshop on March 14th at 6 p.m. It's titled Grow Your Audience, and it's for tips and strategies for growing your listening and viewing audience, developing your own plan for building followers. So this is for people who might have, for example, a radio show or some sort of content on you know, YouTube or a podcast. What do you want from your show? Do you want to grow your audience? What are the challenges that you face? And so we're going to offer some tips and suggestions and just sort of get a dialogue started so that we can all learn more from each other. And again, that's March 14th at 6. You can learn more at 993wbtv.org. If you're interested in sharing this show with out-of-town friends, let them know that archived episodes of Write the Book are available on iTunes and at writethebook.podbean.com as free podcasts. You can visit Write the Book on Twitter and on Facebook for updates, and you can access the podcast at my own website as well. My website is shelaughswithoutus.com. If you have a guest to suggest or comments about the show, or if you have any news about book-related events that you'd like announced during the Bookworm's calendar some week, I do that every week that I have time at the end of the show, please send an email to writethebook@gmail.com. If you like the show, please rate it in iTunes, like it on Facebook, and tell all your friends. I am Shayla Connor Shapiro. You've been listening to Write the Book. This is 99.3 FM WBTV LP Burlington, Vermont, streaming online at 993wbtv.org. Have a great week.